Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
And take me away and turn back the years. Won't you sing me back home before I die? And I recall last Sunday morning, there's a choir across the street came in to sing a few old gospel songs. And I heard him tell the singers, there's a song my mama would sing. Could you sing it once before you move along? Won't you sing with a song I used to hear, make my old memories come alive, and take me away and turn back the years. Won't you sing me back home before I die? Won't you sing the song I used to hear, make my old memories come alive, and take me away and turn back the years. Won't you sing me back home before I die? Won't you sing me back home before I die.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Brad Williams? Y'all like Brad? Brad Williams fronts Arkansas's country band, the Salty Dogs, as well as has several other side projects. More can be found at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 national resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark has shared the stage with, among others, Little Milton Campbell and Little Jimmy King. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist, and tonight's featured artist is Little Rock painter Mara Weir, with this piece right over here entitled Tomatoes, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Mara at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight is our annual Mother's Show, with stories centered around mothers, mothering, and motherhood. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Donna Dillahunty feels the pangs of mothering. And then Mary Elizabeth Woolery is mothered by someone else's parent. Rebecca Parker connects with a stranger through his mother. And we'll end the night with Rhonda Shook as she shares a story her mom does not want preserved. But let's start the night here at Tales from the South with Claire Hahn and memories of her own mother in I Listened.
The only time she was spanked was the day she changed her usual route, returning home from school, took her long black stockings off, and waded in the Forbidden Creek. Now, this was not why she was punished, though. It was for tricking Becky, the little town tattletale, running to tell her mother to report the transgression. "Wait, Becky, I see a shiny new penny on the ground." When Becky bent over to retrieve it, my mother grabbed two handfuls of Becky's long curls, yanked them through the picket fence, and tied her up. The story went that Becky yelled, screamed, while Mother quickly redressed and ran home just in time for supper. My mother and father were only children. Both were spoiled by overindulgent, guilt-inducing, calculating women with strong genes, none of which were recessive. Bets were taken that my parents' marriage would never last when they eloped at Christmas after meeting on summer vacation. However, two boys and two girls would be the product of Martha Craig and James Edwards' union. A girl, then a boy, then 18 years later, another boy and girl. I am the last little girl born when my mother was almost 40. The vision of my sister, a graduating high school senior, with a mother in maternity wear, still gives me pause. Her auburn hair faded to gray, providing visual proof that I was the second grader with the oldest mother. I graduated from kindergarten the same week my older brother graduated from college. Mother was a legend in the PTA, Scouts, and Room Mother activities. Known for her sweet temperament and the ability to make any situation seem planned. She did it all while planning weddings and attending the births of her grandchildren. She collected used eyeglasses for the blind children, blankets for flood-ridden Guatemala, rolled cancer bandages, assisted in the sales of hundreds of boxes of Girl Scout cookies, all dressed in pearls with a perfectly coiffed hairdo and in heels. A Southern Belle mixture of Barbara Bush, June Cleaver, Edith Bunker, and the Dalai Lama. She fed everyone that walked into the house, no matter what time it was or how loudly they protested. Encouraged us to take piano and public speaking. Solved every conflict with, "Well, you'll get over it," or, "I'm not everyone else's mother, I'm yours," and I said no. And although she never knew we knew, she smoked one cigarette each year on New Year's Eve in the bathroom. Plates of juicy apple scrapings, cups of steaming sassafras tea, mint the latum poultices warmed over the floor furnace and slapped on bare chest under our nightshirts. Gagging ST-37 antiseptic gargle gallons of bright red mercurochrome, and a yearly dose of Fletcher's Castoria laxative was the arsenal my mother used to raise four children. As I matured, I was ingrained that nice ladies don't chew gum in public, replenish their lipstick at the dinner table, curse or laugh at off-color jokes. If we had company for dinner, there was a code, too. We used M-I-K, which meant more in the kitchen, or F-G-L, family, go lightly. She felt the world was on an even axis. If we had a chicken cooking in the crock pot, laundry ironed, including my dad's cotton boxer shorts, and we attended church on Sunday. Right before I walked down the aisle at my wedding, she pulled me aside and said, "Sweetheart, you know you don't have to go through with this. Just say the word and we'll get Daddy to explain it to everybody and we'll just go out shopping." Several years later, as I sat in divorce court, I remembered that sage advice. I cried the day she cashed her widow's savings bond to help me and my children pay rent and buy groceries. She never brought it up again. Her joy was unbridled and supportive, unwavering when I married again. I watched through the haze of my own hectic life as my daddy grew ill, passed away. She grew older, and we made arrangements to move her with us to the Mississippi Gulf Coast into her new custom-built mother-in-law's bungalow connected to our house. Taking her evening meals with us, she would pop up after dessert and proclaim, "Well, I need to go home now. Thanks." As she proceeded to walk out my kitchen door into her front door. You would think a move at her age would result in being withdrawn and feeling lonely. Hardly the case. She joined the local women's group, the book club, the garden club, they even named a garden after her, modeled in a fashion show, and rode in the Christmas parade. Almost completely deaf by now, she traveled with a small eraser board and pen. It took a while to get used to it. At first, she was trying to write back her responses. One Easter, Mother was attending the local women's club luncheon where the annual hotly competitive Easter bonnet contest would occur. Early that morning, she enlisted me for bonnet considerations and decided that we needed to honor God's creation and their glory. "You know, we need to be more mindful of the beauty we see every day instead of trying to always improve on everything." I made a quick trip to the dollar store for a plain lace hat as she busily started clipping her Pride of Mobile azalea blossoms. In a wink, she was preening in front of the mirror. Her final instructions, "Now, add a little panache before you go," as she gave it a tilt. "It'll make you so much more interesting." She won first place. During the years, I watched her lose her firstborn, bury two grandchildren, say a final goodbye to her third child, and watch every worldly possession she owned wash away in Katrina. Evacuating to North Little Rock, she found herself back where it all began, the town she and my daddy had eloped to, the place they started their married life. Even with a walker for assistance, she never stopped being involved, attending social functions, art events, and forming those same endearing bonds with new friends. She was featured in the local newspaper, magazines, and everyone loved her, as did all those townspeople in Kentucky some 99 years ago. On the last trip to see her oldest friend, Frida, I was taken aback to see a brand new Cadillac in front of Frida's townhome. Proudly, she invited us for lunch at her usual place. She ate three meals at Shawnee's and even had her own table in the front window. Hesitantly, I climbed into the back seat with this 4 foot 11 inch legally blind Frida hunkered over the steering wheel And my deaf mother taking in the local sights, sitting next to her. Suddenly, Frieda turns to Mother and says, "Martha, am I between the white lines?" To which Mother, never missing a beat, replied, "Pines? No, I don't think those are pines. They look like oak trees to me." Neither of them were the least bit concerned or fazed. It was our last car trip with Frieda. My mother lived her life void of competition, comparisons, or dwelling on what ifs, never asking why me, nor complaining. She filled her conversations with all that was right, joyous, exciting, funny, and treasured. She celebrated what she had had, not what she didn't, just like it had all been planned.
A native of Memphis, Tennessee, Claire Hahn arrived in North Little Rock via the Gulf Coast, propelled by the wake of Hurricane Katrina. A retired RN, she is best known for her enamored granny adventures, community activism, and Facebook-posted photography. Next on Tales from the South, Donna Dillahunty does not want to be in the mother's role in The Hay Bale.
I didn't want to go. I'd planned this moment for months. I'd ironed out so many details. But I didn't want to go. My eyes began to tear. My thoughts wandered as I watched the others going ahead of me to take their places on the hay bales. A gentle tug on my arm pulled me back to the moment. I looked up at the young man standing beside me with my hand tucked in the crook of his arm. I realized that the music I heard was our cue. "Ready, Mama?" he asked. "You can do this," he encouraged. I drew in a shaky breath and smiled up at DJ, one of my borrowed sons. I nodded my head, and we stepped through the lace and burlap curtains together. The brick walk to the bio house stretched forever in front of us. I thought eternity would pass before we reached the first row of hay bales where my seat awaited. I counted each brick underfoot and avoided looking into anyone's face. My lips trembled. My eyes blurred. I'm sure my features contorted into a grimacing caricature of a happy smile. Time was inexplicably elongated, yet in a blink, I was turning to take my seat. DJ hesitated a moment, hugged me, and then walked back up the brick path as I sat down. The oddity of the situation struck me. This was not my place. I didn't belong here. I sat there, alone on my hay bale, feeling awkward and off balance. I was supposed to be at the back, directing the flow of traffic, not at the front. I was always the one to cue the participants, to tell the little girl when to step out and toss her flowers, to straighten the father's boutonniere and smile happily at the glowing girl. I didn't belong on this hay bale. The music changed, and as the vocals floated on the fall breeze, I heard determined boots striking the brick pavers. Heel toe, heel toe. I couldn't turn around. I didn't want to see. A man passed my hay bale, reached the end of the walk, stopped, and turned to look back the way he had come. I studied his face. A shock of black hair drifted across his forehead. He seemed grim, resolute. I looked in his eyes and realized he was struggling to maintain a tight leash on his emotions. Was it fear? Anticipation? Nausea? More footsteps sounded behind me, and again I did not look back. I still felt like I was occupying someone else's seat. I squirmed on my hay bale. Random bits of straw poked my legs through the white sheet covering the bale as if silently protesting my presence. I kept waiting for an usher to escort me out, scolding me for assuming I could claim another's place. Or maybe this was a dream and I would wake at any time. 4 different couples passed by my hay bale as I wrestled with my anxiety and the resentment of the straw. I watched each pair walk to the end of the bricks, separate, and line up on either side of the walkway. 2 young children came forward, the girl scattering leaves and the boy carrying a burlap pillow, following the paths laid out by the couples that had walked before them. The song played through the final chorus, and then, for a moment, silence wrapped itself around us. Even the birds seemed to hesitate. A gentle wind carried the quiet melody of a guitar to my ears. I knew what that meant. Reed and I have coordinated countless ceremonies over the course of our 25-year marriage. I knew what I was supposed to do. For just a moment, though, I rebelled. I wasn't sure I wanted to do this. I wasn't sure that I could. A tidal wave of emotion threatened to drown me in its undertow. The hay bale screamed at me to stand, to do my job. Sheer panic drove me to my feet, and I stifled an unexpected sob as I turned. And I saw her. Oh, I saw Reed, too. But my eyes skittered away from him to linger on her face. I looked at her, taking in the upswept hair, the artful makeup that made her eyes flash dramatically as she looked from side to side, smiling at individuals standing between the rows of hay bales, the rhinestone-encrusted headpiece glittering in the sun, and the soft drape of the ivory lace gown. My eyes saw that image. But my heart saw another. My heart saw a tiny infant swaddled in a blanket, stocking cap on her head, tucked against my body in a hospital bed, just the two of us, because everyone else had gone home. My heart saw a toddler curled up beside me on the couch, watching The Little Mermaid for the gazillionth time. My heart saw a little bitty girl hunting Easter eggs in this same yard. Images flew from my heart and flashed through my mind. A little girl playing with frogs. The same little girl wearing curls and makeup for a dance recital. I saw her with her hair skinned back in a ponytail and a ball cap crammed on her head. I saw her in a cheerleading uniform, looking like the proverbial girl next door. I saw her in a prom dress with her hair piled high on her head, and again when we gave her a car for her 16th birthday. I saw the homecoming queen riding on the trunk of a convertible, waving at me as she passed. I heard a referee whistle and saw her tear down the court, ponytail flying, her face tight with intense determination. Pomp and circumstance echoed in my ears as I saw first the high school cap and gown with the salutatorian honor medal, and then a college cap and gown with honor cords hanging down the front. My brain whirled and my knees trembled. She had almost made it to my hay bale. A little face with chicken pox came to mind. Then a sad, weepy face watching me leave from her dorm parking lot. I heard her soft whisper, deep in my heart, "Mommy, I love you." No, not ready, not enough time. Thought I could do this, but I was wrong. I wanted to kick the annoying hay bale at my feet in outrage. Angrily, I turned back to look at the man who stood silently waiting for her. Did he know what he was taking from me? Did he know he was ripping my heart from my chest? Did he know what this moment cost me? Did he know that she was my life, my breath? I looked hard at him, probing his face with my eyes, hoping to measure his understanding of my inner turmoil. But there was no understanding there for me because he wasn't looking at me. He was looking back down the walkway. He had seen her too. What I saw on his face soothed my heart, wrapped around me, and whispered comfort to my brokenness. His eyes had widened. The hazel irises intensified by the tears brimming against his lower lids. His lips trembled slightly, and he clasped his hands tightly as he watched her approach. I saw on his face an outpouring of adoration and the vulnerability of his soul. At that very second, he was transparent to me, and I breathed in his raw need for her. Peace washed over me, and when I finally took my seat, I found that the hay bale suited me. The straw no longer poked and aggravated, but welcomed me and cushioned my body. Balance was restored. No one would remove me. This was my place, my niche. After all, I was the mother of the bride.
Donna Dillahunty is a fifth grade teacher who lives in Earle, Arkansas. Tonight, she shares her third tale from the South with her fellow Southerners. And yes, on November 2nd, 2013, she was the mother of the bride. Ladies and gentlemen, Brad Williams.
Is everybody doing all right this evening? About a fourth of you? Well, the preacher said all he wanted to say, warning us all about the judgment day, telling us how rock and roll will never stay. And all the sinners, the lovers, and the concubines, living on peace and a bottle of wine. Me and the boys are too scared to do anything tonight. Shout it out, brother, sing that hillside tune. Shout it out, sister, while you're sitting in your upper room. Living in one accord, living by the Spirit and the dying by the soul. Bless us all for heaven's sakes. Say a long prayer tonight, hope it takes. Shout it out, brother. Sing that hillside tune. Shout it out, sister. Telling us how rock and roll never stay.
Next on Tales from the South, Mary Elizabeth Woolery gets the look, but it's not from her own flesh and blood mama in Never Too Old to Scold.
Almost ready to head out for the day, I called my dear, sweet partner in all mischief. Hello, she answered. Hi, Shaney. I was thinking of dropping off a meal at Steph's house before we go to the hospital, rather than after. What do you think? As grown, middle-aged, wed mothers, we learned well in our young woman days in the South that when a friend is in the hospital, it is our duty to feed her family in her absence. Oh, yeah, yeah, great plan. I made a salad, too, to go along with your bread and pasta, so don't forget it. Okay, well, Marla made a dessert, so I'll pick it up, and then I'll head that way. Great, see you in a while. We delivered the food to the home of our dear friend Stephanie, entered the empty house, and loaded the refrigerator, then made our way to the hospital to wait with her family. We entered the emergency room doors and headed to the outpatient surgery area, where we were greeted by Stephanie's children, her husband Randy, and her mother, who we knew as Mrs. Royer, but the family all called her Mom Ellie. Randy spoke to us for a few moments while Stephanie's mom, the epitome of Southern grace, charm, and mother power, stood close by. Finally, Randy, with a funny look on his face, introduced us to Stephanie's mom. Now, we'd met Stephanie's mom many times before, but Randy did this every time we saw Mrs. Royer, so, as though it was a little redundant, there we were again. Eleanor Royer, she said, nice to meet you again. Stephanie is still in surgery, and she will need her rest when she's finished. Thank you, girls, for coming. She turned as if to dismiss us, and we stood a little astonished. Randy's face looked slightly distorted and began to speak, but nothing came out but a small sigh of sorts. Shaney and I grinned, made our way to the seats, and began to make conversation with Stephanie's children. Mrs. Royer didn't look very pleased with us, but she sat quietly across the room with her arms folded. She sat, and we could feel her eyes on us, but we knew better than to make eye contact at that point. Shaney and I both received the mother look more than a few times in our lives, so we knew the damaging, melting power of that heat that was directed our way, and now it was coming from Mom Ellie. As women, we primarily learn from other women. In the South, women tend to garner this knowledge and at times mimic the behaviors of their tenured mentors. It was a wonderful time when a young mother comes into her own mothering style. When she looks into the mirror and sees her mother staring back at her, or hears her mother's voice when she speaks firmly to her children, she knows she has arrived. However, nothing is as priceless as the look. Yes, the look a mother gives to that ill-mannered little tyrant in the church pew or the grocery cart, that piercing glance that in its brevity not only has the power to stop time, but also stops fits of rage and seems to have the ability to make all who see it behave instantaneously, no matter what the age of the look's recipient. Although it is nice to know when we come to this stage as mothers, sadly, we still don't escape our own mother's look. However, at some point, one would think that she could at least escape the look of her friend's mother. Moments passed as we made small talk and continued to defy our dismissal. Just when we thought we were in the clear, she unfolded her arms and leaned forward just a little as if she were going to say something. But suddenly, the doors opened. Miller, the doctor said. Randy and Mrs. Royer stood immediately and made their way over to the doctor. Shaney and I stood in the background. Upon hearing glad tidings of a successful surgery, Randy made his way over to us. She did great. She'll be out of recovery and headed upstairs to room 437 in just a few. But before he could get the rest of his sentence out, Mrs. Royer interrupted. And she will need her rest. I will tell her you came by and wished her well. Thank you, girls. Once again, she dismissed us. Taken aback, we said goodbye and walked toward the door, knowing that we had been defeated. Then, as if our minds were one, we gave each other a sideways glance and giggled as if we were about to disobey. And we were so about to disobey. We exited through the emergency room door and burst into laughter, rounded the corner, walked clear around to the other side of the hospital, re-entered, hopped on the elevator, and went to room 437. We walked through the door to the busyness of nurses preparing the room. Randy entered, looking surprised, and said, "Oh, you're gonna get it." Shaney and I burst into laughter, only to be interrupted by a gurney carrying our dear friend. Nurses situated the bed, and we waited patiently to see Steph open her eyes. Note, Mrs. Royer wasn't there yet. Leaning in, we saw Stephanie open her sleepy, drugged eyes and smile. "Hi, you guys love me," she said in her drunken stupor. We laughed and said, "Yes, we do. How do you feel?" She didn't get to answer before Randy informed her that we had been naughty, and Mom Ellie was not going to be happy when she arrived. Steph started laughing hysterically. Then we all laughed. I really don't know if she was laughing because she knew that we were going to get in trouble or if she was still very happy with her medication. However, the laughter ended quite abruptly when this tiny woman with the slightest Mississippian accent and air stood in the doorway, arms folded, glasses at the tip of her nose, and foot tapping. "Girls." That's all she said. We looked up, saw her looking at us, and immediately, as if our own mothers were standing there threatening us within an inch of our lives, our heads shot to the ground in hangdog shame. We turned red and shuffled toward the door and out of the room. Behind us, we heard our friend, "Mom, they're my friends," with only the reply of, "You need your rest," then the quiet. We didn't look back. If we hadn't learned anything in 35 plus years, we had learned not to look at the judge when we are guilty, but those are stories for other times. We entered the elevator and burst into laughter, both of us talking through that laughter about how we had almost gotten away with it and found how fun it was to act out every once in a while. To this day, we giggle about Mom Ellie and her good intentions. We value her teachings as dearly as we value our own mother's lessons in motherhood and motherlook power.
Mary Elizabeth Woolery is an Arkansas transplant, former English instructor, and current university program coordinator. She spends her spare time with her family and friends creating opportunities to laugh, learn, and love. Next on Tales from the South, Rebecca Parker meets a man whose mother forever stays with her in Mama Prevailed.
Obviously, I'm lost, I said as I entered a small cafeteria set up somewhere in Veterans Hospital in Little Rock. I had driven down to visit my brother-in-law, Carl, who had come in with a heart problem. And as I was leaving the hospital, I realized I was completely turned around. Only two tables were occupied, one over in the corner by an older man who was having a sandwich, and the other by an elderly couple who sat together in the center of the room. The gentleman in the corner said he understood how easy it was to get lost in the place and offered to escort me out when he finished his sandwich. I thanked him, and the man at the center table spoke up and said, "Don't feel bad. I've been coming here since 1945, and I still get lost." "Oh, you are a World War II veteran then," I asked. "Yes," he answered. "I fought in Europe, both me and my brother. We were all over that place, but never ran into each other the whole time we were there. After we came home, we realized that one time we had been in the same place at the same time, but we never knew it. We fought through that war after they sent us over there, and we both came home in one piece. I got wounded a couple of times, but never very badly. I don't know how we managed to come home whole when there were boys dying all around us." I looked him full in the face, completely caught up in the story he was telling. "I know why you and your brother came back," I said, astounding him and myself as well. "You do?" he asked. "Yes," I said, not pausing to think about the absurdity of what I was about to say to a complete stranger. "You and your brother came home because your mother was praying for you." His face lit up with a smile and his eyes shone with pure joy. "You know," he said, "she was praying for us. My mother had something. People made fun of her and called her a holy roller, but it never hindered her." I smiled as I said to him, "Yes, I understand, because my mother was a holy roller too." "We don't have no doubt about where they are now, do we?" he asked me, looking as though he might have just caught a glimpse of our mothers shouting together in Glory Land. "No, we don't," I said, smiling, knowing that my face reflected back to him the same emotion that shone upon his own. The gentleman who had offered to show me out had finished his lunch by this time and came over to walk me out. I thanked the veteran for telling me his story, and he said it was his pleasure. I did not ask his name, and I did not tell him mine. But in that moment, I knew him, and he knew me. Names were not important. Something wonderful happened for us in that room, and we both knew it. His wife, who sat quietly by his side during the conversation, smiled sweetly at me as I turned to leave. I returned her smile and gave her a little wave. I could not get the man and his story off my mind as I drove home that day. I have heard and read many stories and watched many movies about World War II, but this little story was as profound to me as any I had ever heard. In that awful time, while a war was tearing the world apart and bombs and bullets were daily taking an awful toll. A mother was praying for God to bring her boys home to her, and somewhere in a lonely little cabin in the Ozark Mountains of Arkansas, that little mother, down on her knees, moved heaven and earth, and her boys came home.
Rebecca Parker is a retired Spanish teacher and an Arkansas native who enjoys the beauty of her home state and the down-home friendliness of Arkansas people. Please help me welcome back the Salty Dogs, Brad Williams.
You said you weren't happy, you were ready for a change, so you changed your telephone number, and then you changed your last name, with no thought for tomorrow, no reason or rhyme. I just can't help wondering why you turned. Packed up half of mine with no thought for tomorrow, no reason or rhyme. I just can't help wondering why you turn this water to wine. Strong drinks and fears and bottles full of tears. Left is your memory, many years of free time. All this time for drinking this water you turned to wine.
In our final story of the night, Rhonda Shook's mother ignores history, but Rhonda doesn't in Genetics.
My mother died in the intensive care unit of the Johnson County Regional Hospital. My father was standing by her bedside when Dr. Boyce West rushed in and zapped her back to life. Ever since then, both she and my father have been dedicated to preserving family history. They have gathered and reproduced hundreds, perhaps thousands, of photographs, which they compile in gargantuan three-ring binders, along with typewritten accounts of the events which precipitated or followed each image. This tome is known to my family as the book, and each Christmas, my siblings and I receive new pages for it. When I received my first installment, I used the book as part of my daily exercise regimen. After a few years, I had to abandon bench pressing, but I could still make use of the book by incorporating leg lifts. My calves never looked better. As the family grew, so did the book, and soon it was bigger than any home gym. I had to remove it from my library because the other books were expressing feelings of inadequacy. In the book, there's an ancestral section filled with dog-eared black and white photographs, small and irregularly shaped. Weathered faces with handlebar mustaches stare back at the reader, tobacco staining the creases in downturned lips, and then there are the men. I Another section chronicles my parents' courtship, which started when they were 12 and is still, even now, disgustingly affectionate. Each child has a section, starting with me, a synopsis of our first few years, accompanied by embarrassingly unflattering photographs. Even more embarrassing to me is the inclusion of some of my early writings, painfully primitive, yet they're on display for all to see. The most interesting thing about the book is what isn't in it. The most intriguing story imaginable is not in the book, but here it is for you. The heroine of this story is Mary Will Shook, my grandmother, and the adventure begins in 1988. Picture my grandmother at 89 years old. Her spine has an osteoporosis curve, so she stands several inches shorter than her optimum 5'6". She lives on three musketeer bars and saltine crackers and weighs about 90 pounds. She has lost her right eye to glaucoma and replaced it with one made of glass. She doesn't own a pair of pants, only dresses. She uses Clairol B6 Ebony on her gray hair, resulting in an almost fluorescent blue-black. And she has a penchant for cowboy hats. One year at the county fair, my grandmother spotted the most stunning accessory, an elegant feather on a fanciful string with a metal clasp. The nice boy who sold it to her called it a roach clip, as Mary Will proudly fastened it to her white faux Stetson. Now that she's firmly situated in your mind's eye, let's get on with the adventure. Mary Will has a sister, Leona, but this is the South, so she's called Leonie. Leona, 10 years younger than my grandmother, has a boyfriend, Roy Monahan, who is another 5 years younger than Leona. So, if you're doing the math, there's a 15-year age difference between Roy and Mary. Pay attention, this will impress you later. My grandmother didn't have a driver's license, so when she visited her sister, Leona had to do all the driving. They lived in towns about half an hour apart, but spent quite a bit of time together. One day, at the end of an enjoyable weekend visit, the sisters are outside saying goodbye to Roy. It's a lovely day, and Mary feels pretty. She chats flirtatiously on about nothing in particular, and Leona begins to feel a bit uneasy. Just annoyed at first, but then her sister laughs a laugh as light as air, a laugh that says, "How very clever you are, you big strong man," and it makes Leona crazy. Leona takes a deep breath and checks her anger. This is Mary, after all, and she's always been like this. Roy Monahan is not going to fall for an old, bent woman with blue hair and a glass eye. Just breathe, she tells herself and to her sister. Come on, Mary Will, it's time to get you home. But Mary doesn't hear her. She's completely absorbed in conversation with Roy. She laughs again, and this time she touches his arm. Leona spins on her heel and stomps to the carport. I don't have all day, she hurls over her shoulder. She folds in, slams the door, and starts the car. Her sister's impatience has little effect on my grandmother. She finishes her conversation and sashays to the car. Inside the Oldsmobile, Leona is seething. In the rearview mirror, she can see her sister walking slowly, swaying her hips, smiling. Leona yanks the gear shift into reverse and floors it. After she backed over her sister, Leona felt odd. It was kind of like backing over a suitcase. That's what she would tell everyone, she decided. I thought it was a suitcase. So she pulled forward and ran over her again. And the story never made it into the book. Unbelievable. I can imagine that many of you are horrified. How can she write so callously about the loss of her grandmother? But here's the impressive part. She didn't die. Of course, she had multiple injuries, life-threatening injuries. Bruised kidney, broken tailbone, crushed pelvis. Every rib was broken, but it didn't kill her. The doctors cautioned us not to expect her to make it through the first night, but she did make it through the night, and the next night, and the next. She had an overwhelming fear of being sent to a rest home, so she worked diligently at recovery. In record time, my grandmother was well enough to come home. She would need an in-home care provider, the hospital staff informed us. Guess who Mary hired? Roy Monahan moved in with my grandmother and stayed long after her recovery. Years after her recovery, and the story never made it into the book. When I demanded to know why, my father expressed his fear that it might cause hard feelings between family members. Harder than turning each other into speed bumps? Come on. It's a great story, one that I simply cannot resist. First, the lead characters are fascinating females who share a painful, yes, but glorious adventure and emerge shining. Mary Will, a world-class hypochondriac, would never complain of a mundane sick headache again. She was set for life. And as for Leona, well, she experienced the ultimate in retaliation. She pissed me off, so I ran her down. Who wouldn't kill to have bragging rights like that? Second, the story is malleable. It's pliant, open to interpretation. In short, it's perfect for storytelling. Was the car really an Oldsmobile? I don't know. Do I have the ages, the years, the maths right? Who cares? Only two people were actually involved, and their stories differ dramatically. Roy saw the car run over my grandmother twice, but has no means of determining whether or not it was intentional. An accident or attempted homicide? Which would a good Southern writer choose? Third, and perhaps most importantly, the reason the story deserves inclusion in the book is that it offers familial consolation. To me, at least, when I make a bad decision, when I choose the wrong man, or seek revenge when I should pardon, when my anger turns to pyromania, I find queer comfort in thinking it's not me, it's genetic. Maybe some women want to boast of tidy foremothers, women who dressed and spoke and lived properly. I am not one of those women. I want to kick down doors and crash through windows. I want to rescue refugees and rebuild what has been ravaged. I want to wage war on illiteracy and oppression, and I find strength in the stories. So here you go, Mom. One more for the book. Happy Mother's Day.
Dr. Rhonda Shook is a playwright from Clarksville, Arkansas, whose work has been produced in New York, Chicago, and the jungles of Thailand. She currently teaches communication and film theory at the University of the Ozarks. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tonight's show is dedicated to our fellow Arkansans who were affected by the devastating storms and tornadoes that blew through here Sunday, April 27th, and all of the relief and rebuilding efforts. We love you. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks for listening this evening. Got one more song. My name's Brad Williams. And part of a band here in town called the Salty Dogs. Maybe you've heard of us before.
You oversized love. You better pull to the side.
rig from town to town, and hope besides war, you're never gonna slow me down. And I pulled down on Highway 55, I heard that asphalt start to whine, and then I realized I was in Arkansas. Look here, mama, do you see what I see? You oversized load, you better pull to the side of the road, and never, 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 never gonna slow me down. Well, you oversized load, you better pull to the side of the road.
Everybody, appreciate it. Glad you're here. Hope you have a good time tonight. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Tamanos Publishing, with additional support provided by AY Magazine, William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American Magazine. Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio Productions. Our graphics are by Robin Steves at Studio B. Our musician is Mark Simpson. Our stage art is by V.L. Cox. Our production engineer is Jay Jones. And our executive producer and host is Paula Morrell. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.